I'm Maria Konnikova.
And I'm Nate Silver.
And our new podcast, Risky Business, is a show about making better decisions. We're both journalists who moonlight as poker players, and that's the lens we're going to use to approach this entire show.
We're going to be discussing everything from high-stakes poker to personal questions.
Like whether I should call a plumber or fix my shower myself.
And of course, we'll be talking about the election, too.
Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Revisionist history. People who did bad things love that. We're not going to let them get away with that tonight. We have Jeffrey Tucker on here tonight. We are packed with so much stuff. Aaron McIntyre, my goodness, what a night on I'm Right. You ever get in a fight with your wife or your husband, girlfriend, boyfriend, whatever it may be, get in an argument with somebody and you lose your temper, and maybe you say a thing or two that you kind of wish you could have back. Did that ever happen to you? Oh, it's definitely happened to me. I think it's happened to all of us. You do things, and then you say things, and then you're embarrassed about something. And then afterwards, after things have calmed down, she'll say something like, I can't believe you told me that I was stupid, and you're ashamed. You wish you hadn't said it. You know you said it. So what do you do? It's human nature. What do you do? Still, I didn't say that. Stupid. Oh, I don't remember saying that. I think you heard me wrong. Because you don't want to have an accounting of where you did wrong, of what you said wrong, do you? That's uncomfortable. So you lie. And you want to act like it never happened because an accounting of what you did wrong is going to be uncomfortable. We are never, ever, 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 ever on this show going to let COVID lockdowns go. Ever. If you're holding out for that, you're going to be holding out until the day they kick me off the air. This country turned into a tyranny over a chest cold. The citizens of this nation allowed it. The Republicans and Democrats who ran the federal government at the time encouraged it, prompted it. The evil bureaucrats who run the medical institutions in this country abused us. The media people, governors, mayors, this country turned into North Korea over a severe chest cold, and I'm not going to let the tyrants go. And I understand full well that the American people want to let the tyrants go. I understand that, and you can see that. Maybe you don't. I mean, you probably don't. You can see evidence of that at the polls, you see. People did not go out and vote for all this backlash against COVID lockdowns. They just didn't. They let it all go. I have not, and I will not. And I've not forgotten the worst actors in the whole thing either. Let's talk about death for a moment. Because what we're discussing here is lives. Lives ruined, lives ended. Do you remember what happened in New York? Let me just give you a little background on what happened in New York during COVID. You gotta really take all this in before we go to Andrew Cuomo. So New York, they were billing themselves as being, you know, super anti-Trump, and we're gonna do COVID the right way. And this is when Andrew Cuomo was leading things there. And Trump was bending over backwards, many would say too backwards, to try to help everyone. Remember he sent a hospital ship up there because they were claiming the hospitals were overwhelmed? Remember when all the hospitals were overwhelmed? And Andrew Cuomo was all, no, we don't need any of your help. No, get out of here. That's Trump help. And as part of the rejecting of Trump's help, Andrew Cuomo gave an order. An order to what? To return people who have COVID to their nursery homes or house them in nursery homes. Now, COVID, it may not be a threat to you or me, but if you're older, it is. Certainly if you're older, pre-existing conditions, if you're super fat, it can be deadly. So the people who were most vulnerable to COVID, Andrew Cuomo sent COVID-positive people into their home, and 15,000 New Yorkers died because of Andrew Cuomo. You could make the argument. Because of Andrew Cuomo's COVID insanity, mandates this, mandates that, lockdown this, nursing home, take that. You can make the argument that Andrew Cuomo as governor killed more of his citizens than any governor in the history of the United States of America with his COVID protocols. You could easily make that argument. In fact, You'd have a hard time arguing against me if I made that argument. And so now Andrew Cuomo's out there interviewing Dr. Witch and saying things like this.
The government had no capacity to enforce any of this. You must wear a mask. And people wore masks in New York. But if they said, I'm not wearing a mask, there was nothing I could do about it. You must close your private business. I won't. Well, there was nothing I could really do about it. It was really all voluntary, and it was extraordinary when you think about it, that society acted with that uniformity voluntarily, because I had no enforcement capacity.
Obviously, that's Andrew Cuomo trying to rewrite history, ease the burden of his legacy, which is that of a governor who killed 15,000 of his own people. But you know what I got most from that? It's not even really about Andrew Cuomo. It's understandable that old, tired tyrant would want to try to doctor up the history books a little bit, make his legacy look better. That would be understandable. What really hit me most about that clip was, he's right. He's right about this part of it. I mean, he's right that we could have just said no. The land of the free people of this country could have just said, no, actually, I'm not closing my business. Nope, our school will be open. No, I'm not going to wear a mask. No, I'm not going to do this. Now, there are a laundry list of reasons. The propaganda effort around COVID was as big as anything we've ever seen. There's a laundry list of reasons that didn't happen. But on some level there, he's right. And look, you know what? We'll move up. We'll move past Cuomo. We'll move past us for a moment. I want to remember something else. Do you remember, it's going to take a minute to take it all in. Do you remember social distancing and what that meant? Remember, almost all the lockdown insanity came as a result of the concept of social distancing, almost all of it. Why couldn't they go to school? Well, you had to be 6 feet away from everyone. Why did you have to stand on those stupid little footsteps in the grocery store? You had to be 6 feet away from everyone. I'm here in Texas. Restaurants couldn't open, but when they could open, they could only open at 50% capacity. Why only 50%? So you could stay 6 feet away from everyone. 6 feet away, 6 feet away, stand 6 feet away. We completely reordered American society around that concept, and these people want you to forget that they just made it up.
The initial recommendation that the CDC brought to the White House, and I talk about this, was 10 feet. And a political appointee in the White House said, we can't recommend 10 feet. Nobody can measure 10 feet. It's inoperable. Society will shut down. So the compromise was around 6 feet.
What? Hey, surely there's some science behind these footprints I'm standing in the grocery store. It's science? What? I don't know. What can we get away with, guys? These people, man. Chris Cuomo, speaking of the Cuomo family, don't mean to pick on that particular family, he's all over the place out there today saying things like he's taking ivermectin.
I am taking a, what do they call it? Like a regular dose, you know, whatever. They're trying to build up of ivermectin. Hmm. Ivermectin was a boogeyman early on in COVID. Mm-hmm.
You couldn't talk about it.
That was wrong. And my doctor, who is now my doctor, was using it during COVID on her family and on patients. And it was working for them. So they were wrong to play scared on that. Didn't know that at the time. Know it now. Admit it now. Reporting on it now. Because I think that's the job.
In case you're wondering what he had to say at the time about ivermectin, this is what he had to say at the time.
People who are injecting drugs for animals and horse.
And people telling them to.
Oh my God.
What person? You know, you talk about like, you know, cancel culture and who to shame. Ivermectin, a dewormer. Really?
They are shaming themselves. No one has to shame them. They're shaming themselves.
No, they need to be shamed.
Yeah.
They need to be called out and shamed, yeah. Brother.
And he's doing the no one told us, we didn't know thing. And that would be acceptable, except I knew. I don't have some special access to a doctor or medical information. The information was all over the place out there. There were all kinds of doctors talking about it, using it, giving it to their patients. Many, many, many people knew. No, you're trying to make things better now. And one more thing on the COVID stuff. It was all over the news yesterday. AstraZeneca is pulling their COVID vaccine off of the market. We now have people like Dr. Birx out there saying, well, obviously it causes harm. We have lawsuit after lawsuit after lawsuit. We know that therapeutic hurts people. There's no question about it. Whatever else it may do, I don't know. It hurts people on a level that would have had any other medicine pulled off of the market. We know that by now. And now that we know that, I just want to look back and just sit back and enjoy all the safe and effective propaganda you had to endure.
The thing that went right was the investment over decades in the basic and clinical biomedical research that allowed us to make a vaccine in unprecedented time of less than a year that turned out to be safe and highly effective.
They are safe and so effective.
We know that vaccines are safe and effective.
The data is so compelling that these vaccines are safe and effective.
I have really good news. Today, our nation has achieved a medical miracle. We have delivered a safe and effective vaccine in just 9 months. This is one of the greatest scientific accomplishments in history.
But it wasn't. It wasn't. Was it? And we should have accountability. We need it so we can't have these tyrants doing this revisionist history. We can't let them get away with it. No, you did wrong. Admit it. Well, that may have made you uncomfortable, but I am right. Jeffrey Tucker is going to join me next to discuss these things. Before he does that, I love coffee. I'm drinking coffee right now. You like that? Like my little coffee mug? See what it says right there? Pro-life, God, guns, and coffee. That's my blackout coffee. I drink 2 cups every single day. Sometimes I wait till I get to the studio here. They have the best coffee I've ever tasted, and they mail it to my front door. I love those two things already. But what I love most is that they share my values. Yes, it's the best cup of coffee ever, but that wouldn't matter to me if it was yet another coffee company that hates me. These coffee companies, they hate our guts. They're all DEI and ESG and whatnot, not Blackout. Blackout doesn't apologize for you or apologize for America. Go to blackoutcoffee.com/Jesse, promo code Jesse. Blackoutcoffee.com/Jesse, promo code Jesse.
I'm Maria Konnikova.
And I'm Nate Silver.
And our podcast, Risky Business, is a show about making better decisions. Both Nate and I are journalists who moonlight as poker players. We've both won, and I have to say lost, hundreds of thousands of dollars playing poker. And poker is a lens that we're going to use to approach this entire show, because poker isn't just about playing cards. It's actually about how to make good decisions. It's an entire framework for thinking about the world.
In addition to poker, we'll be talking about the wide world of gambling, so sports betting, for example, plus the news, politics, it is an election year, and personal decisions too.
Like whether I should call a plumber or fix my shower myself.
Tune into Risky Business every Thursday.
Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
There were not very many people who got COVID right from the very, very, very beginning. Jeffrey Tucker was one of them. Founder, president of the Brownstone Institute. He also wrote a book about it, which was outstanding, Life After Lockdown. But Jeffrey was there in the beginning saying, what? What? Jeffrey, today, the Cuomo brothers, Deborah Birx, AstraZeneca, everybody and their brother's going to try to just take that eraser to the history books, trying to clean things up, if you will. And it irks me to no end. You know why it irks me? Because I know they're going to get away with it.
Yeah, this is sadly true. We like to imagine a fantasy world in which, you know, people cause a calamity, say, whoops, that was a mistake. We got off track. Our models were wrong. We forgot our lessons from pandemic history. We got our epidemiology wrong. Please accept our apologies. We'll make amends. That is not what's happening. Instead, they're doubling down. They're covering up their tracks. They're retaining their power. They're plotting new things. They're angry at us instead of themselves. They're angry at the world for not complying with their models. And they're living in fear right now for, you know, fear of justice, fear of being found out, fear of having their power taken away. And unfortunately, there's many people that are enabling this. And part of the problem is that so many people were wrong from the very beginning that they're all implicated. You know, I mean, it's the Democrats, the Republicans, all the bureaucracies, news media, big tech, everybody. And so, unfortunately, whereas I used to think that we'd see a mass wave of apologies and regret, we're seeing a mass wave of censorship and denial.
Doesn't this, in the end, come back to the American people? Isn't this on the American people? Jeffrey, I know you saw that new Andrew Cuomo clip where he said, hey, we couldn't even enforce any of this stuff. We couldn't enforce this. We couldn't enforce that. And look, it's not that I want to just absolve Andrew Cuomo of any blame. He's a monster. He's a tyrant. I can't stand the guy. Throw him in prison for all I care. But he's not wrong. The American people were more than willing to go along with these things that have destroyed them.
Well, you know, Jesse, it's a little bit ambiguous because it infuriates me when Andrew Cuomo says these kinds of things, because it's actually true that in Manhattan, people were terrified. You know, bar owners were threatened all the time by the police. You know, that you have to serve fries with that drink. You know how that controlled COVID? I don't know. You couldn't just order a drink on its own. It had to be with fries or some meal or something like that. And this stuff was, in fact, enforced, especially the vaccine mandates were enforced. You know, you couldn't go into a bar. So they had the cops, you know, circling through restaurants, checking your papers to make sure you were there. And, I recognize, too, that there was a strange sense of we didn't know what was required and what was not, what was the recommendation, what was the law. When CISA of the Homeland Security sent out a note that said, from now on, you have to figure out if you're an essential or unessential worker, and if you're not essential, you can't go to work. Was that law? I mean, it was lawless in a sense. But it felt very much like martial law. You know, it's like all your existing laws are going to be replaced under these emergency circumstances. And we didn't know what the penalties were. We didn't know who was going to enforce it. We didn't know who was going to get in trouble if we didn't go along. So people were scared. And I've maintained, honestly, Jesse, for years, that people were more scared of the response than they were of the virus. Now, I can't prove that, but I don't believe that, you know, people's fear of COVID was the only factor here. People were afraid of their government and afraid of what was happening to the country. It felt extremely strange. So there's this general sort of fear of getting in trouble, fear of what was happening to the country. How come I can't go to church? You know, why is it I'm not allowed to visit the old folks home that I'm paying for when my grandmother is? How come I can't see my spouse in the hospital? You know, it was such a confusing time. Why is the media all marching in lockstep on this craziness? So that was a major source of the fear. I remember I was in New York on March 11th, coming back, or maybe it was March 12th. And I remember riding the Amtrak back from my trip, being afraid that the train would be stopped and we would all be quarantined. And I walked up to the conductor of the train, or at least the guy who was on my car, you know, that worked for Amtrak. And I said, what are the chances that this train could be stopped and we could all be in quarantine? He said, well, I don't think it's likely, but I suppose it's possible. And that could actually happen. Okay, so nobody knew really what the laws were instructing us. We didn't know if we were even allowed to be on the train and what would happen to us. And my fears weren't alone. Of course, I had studied the issue, so I was aware of their powers. But I think a lot of people intuited at the time that the world had just gone nuts. And it wasn't so much the fear of the virus, but everything else. And that's what kept people home. It was just a fear of, like, why is the world going so crazy? And as you say, yeah. You know, this issue that you just identified about, you know, the forgetting, you know, the sort of sweeping it under the rug, which frustrates you and it frustrates me. It's why I started Brownstone, because I didn't want it to be swept under the rug. Partially, I'm wondering how much this has to do with trauma in general. You know, there's an element of human psychology that when people are traumatized in something like this, there is a way in which our brains just sort of want to, you know, sweep it aside and forget about it and just move on. So you've got this sort of pretend world going on today. We're all pretending like this never happened. You know, we're all pretending that, you know, two successive Easters weren't canceled, for example, you know? I mean, but it did happen. And I firmly believe that we need to come to terms with it and talk about it and figure out why it happened, you know, who did this to us and why, and who bears responsibility for it. I really think there needs to be a commission, investigations, even prosecutions for what happened. And if we don't remember it, we're going to just go on. The other thing, Jesse, that's really important here is that the world's been seriously damaged as a result. You know, there was an article that appeared yesterday in the Wall Street Journal talking about the pandemic of truancy in our schools. I mean, basically, people don't feel like they have to show up to school anymore. Okay. Well, that's a consequence of the school closures, you know? You're seeing restaurants, you know, struggling right now. I mean, restaurants that, you know, were thriving 5 years ago are now just barely surviving. And things are getting worse. The inflation is killing the American standard of living. Real income is declining fast. We're seeing a whole generation wondering what the point is. You know, our churches are nowhere near as full. The museums are, you know, have fewer than half the visitors they used to. We've got a real estate crisis developing in the cities right now, to the point that, you know, in a few years, if this continues, we're going to see large skyscrapers just being imploded because nobody can afford to keep them up anymore. I mean, all of these things trace directly to what began in March 2020. They all trace to the pandemic response that literally unleashed hell on civilization itself. And it's pointless just to observe all this carnage all around us and not talk about what led to it.
Yeah, we have to have these conversations. We absolutely have to. Jeffrey, you are the best, sir. As always, please come back anytime. I'm glad he's on it. He's been on it for a long time. That's a good book. Highly recommend it. Speaking of books, Arne McIntyre, you know he joins us all the time on the show. One of the sharpest guys. I lean on Arne for how if I'm thinking about an issue or perspective on things. He's one of those people, I really, really heed his voice on things, and he wrote a book, and he's going to come and he's going to talk to us about it in a moment. Before we get to Arne, let's talk about sleeping. Spend a third of your life in bed. How do you sleep at night? You ever heard of dream powder? It's not a drug, I swear. We're not trafficking it over the border. It's healthy, actually. It's all natural. It's from Beam. It's, you know, all kinds of different things in it, but no big pharma crap, no nothing. You pour it. I get the cinnamon chocolate. They have chocolate peanut butter. They have all kinds of stuff, but I just pour it in a little glass of milk, warm it up in the microwave, stir it up, and just as I'm ready for bed, just sip on it. 20 minutes, 30 minutes. It's not that you just pass out, right? It's not that kind of thing. You just drift off to sleep. And when you wake up, you're not groggy. That's the thing for me. I've been groggy. Anything I've ever taken to sleep in my life, it doesn't matter what it is. I wake up and I'm miserable the next day. Tired, doesn't matter. Not dream powder. I love this stuff. I have a pack. I will have several packs in my home the rest of my life. You want some? 40% off. Shopbeam.com/Jesse Kelly. Shopbeam.com/Jesse Kelly. We'll be back.
I'm Maria Konnikova.
And I'm Nate Silver.
And our podcast, Risky Business, is a show about making better decisions. Both Nate and I are journalists who moonlight as poker players. We've both won, and I have to say lost, hundreds of thousands of dollars playing poker. And poker is a lens that we're going to use to approach this entire show, because poker isn't just about playing cards. It's actually about how to make good decisions. It's an entire framework for thinking about the world.
In addition to poker, we'll be talking about the wide world of gambling, so sports betting, for example, plus the news, politics, it is an election year, and personal decisions, too.
Like whether I should call a plumber or fix my shower myself.
Tune into Risky Business every Thursday.
Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
All right. Told you he was coming. Told you he wrote a book. I don't have to even introduce him anymore, Aaron McIntyre. He does a show on The Blaze, but now he's a world-famous author, and he really did. He wrote an incredible book called The Total State. He's been on this show many, many, many times talking about this concept, the total state, the total state. He wrote a book about it. So, Aaron, what is the total state?
Well, Jesse, I think like a lot of people, I saw what happened in 2020 and I was like, why isn't the Constitution, why aren't the Bill of Rights stopping all of this? How are the churches being closed? How's the government taking over all of this power? And as I wrote this book, what I realized is that the government has grown well beyond the boundaries envisioned by the founders. It's not just the three branches. Of course, we know the deep state and all the power that's been moved out of the elected government into these unelected bureaucracies. But it's also grown into the private sector. It's moved into the media. It's moved into corporations and NGOs that have global reach that come in and dictate into the United States how they should run the government. And so what we've really seen is that the total state has assembled itself by growing around the limitations on power that were created by the founding fathers in the Constitution. And that's why we feel like we have an increasingly tyrannical government, even though we're supposed to have all these checks and balances that limit the government in the United States.
Aaron, something that hit me during COVID, it's hit me before, but man, during COVID, it was more evident than at any point in time in my life, is how the system, which is what I call it whatever, how they all speak with one voice. You can turn on CNN at night and the anchor is saying one thing, and then the doctor from the CDC is saying this, and the FDA is saying that, and the Democrat politician is saying the same thing, and the Republican politician is saying the same thing. They all speak with one voice at all times, and they're almost always lying. It blows me away how coordinated they are.
Yeah, that's really the thing that you have to think about, right? In a normal totalitarian state, we would know there would be, you know, Joseph Goebbels, or there would be the Politburo in the Soviet Union. There would be someone who has an official job of coordinating the message. But we don't have that in the United States. And so one of the questions I try to answer in the book is, how do we end up with this coordinated total state, even though there's not one central like conspiracy running this whole thing? And the answer really is that all of our elite institutions are thinking with the same mind. They're moving with the same morals because they share the same worldview, the same structure about how they should be able to totally rewrite the human being. They think that they have the authority to socially engineer every person in the United States. And they think that they have the authority to rule with this unified idea of what humanity should become. So while there's no top-down conspiracy, everyone goes to the same institutions. They all have the same incentives. They all have the same friends, cocktail parties. They get married to the same class of people, and they share those class interests. And that's what moves them to speak with one voice.
All right, Aaron, you wrote a piece for The Blaze talking about these street animals having fun out there now. Hate binds a bizarre coalition of contradictory leftist forces. What are you talking about?
Well, Jesse, I think the problem that a lot of conservatives have when they look at the left is they see it as one monolithic force, right? They see it as this omnipotent, unified idea of what the United States should be. But like we said, it's actually more of a loose coalition that share a similar worldview. And that worldview is really animated by their hatred towards America. They really all benefit from the idea that they can dismantle what America is and kind of chop it down and pass it out to their client classes. It's a bunch of people who have contradictory interests, right? We have traditional Muslims who are arguing alongside Queers for Palestine. And normally these people can and would kill each other. But for some reason in the United States, they're all working together. And the reason they're doing that is really only because they're unified by a shared enemy. And that shared enemy is you and me.
Aaron, why Why don't we have a GOP that's actually an opposing party? We see it all the time. It's not exactly news. The uniparty is one of those words that everyone uses out there now. But why? Doesn't it make sense in a society where the people are so against all this stuff that a real opposition party would rise? Why don't we have an opposition party?
Because really, the GOP are just second-tier elites who couldn't rule the people they really wanted to. Most Republicans are just embarrassed Democrats forced to rule over the middle of America that they really don't like. They're all looking for the same social hierarchy, the same prestige system. They want the same articles written by the same newspapers to tell them they're good boys and give them a pat on the head. All the incentives are lined up for them to serve power and this shared prestige system, not to serve the people that are supposed to be electing them. And so over and over again, they choose the interests of the system and the things that will keep them in power rather than the things that are supposed to be the interests of the people who send them to Washington in the first place.
Aaron, how can people get their hands on The Total State? I know it's everywhere now. I think it's like a national bestseller already. How do people get their hands on this thing?
Yeah, of course, you can order it on Amazon. It's at Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, Target, other big retailers. But really appreciate it, man. It's been fantastic to get the book out there.
Yeah, it's a great read. I highly, highly, highly recommend it. Aaron, you are the man, my brother, as always. All right. Now, before we talk about liberal white women, let's talk about your timeshare, the one you think you're stuck in. You're not stuck in your timeshare. You know that. Lone Star Transfer exists. Therefore, you're not stuck in your timeshare. This is a family business that will get you legally and permanently out of the timeshare you think you're stuck in. Stop paying those annual fees, which have gone up. I know they've doubled on you. The special assessments. I know they're telling you, oh, sorry, you can't even get in this year. I understand how all that's going. Just get a hold of Lone Star Transfer. Stop calling the timeshare company. They put it in writing 99% of the time. They write it down. It's guaranteed. And they give you a time frame. They'll get you free. 844-310-2646. We're all cutting costs right now. Get out of that timeshare. We'll be back.
I'm Maria Konnikova.
And I'm Nate Silver.
And our podcast, Risky Business, is a show about making better decisions. Both Nate and I are journalists who moonlight as poker players. We've both won, and I have to say lost, hundreds of thousands of dollars playing poker. And poker is a lens that we're going to use to approach this entire show, because poker isn't just about playing cards. It's actually about how to make good decisions. It's an entire framework for thinking about the world.
In addition to poker, we'll be talking about the wide world of gambling, so sports betting, for example, plus the news, politics, it is an election year, and personal decisions, too.
Like whether I should call a plumber or fix my shower myself.
Tune into Risky Business every Thursday.
Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The psychopath Democrat, the mentally ill single woman at home on 15 anti-anxiety medications, sits there and looks at all her cats and says, oh my God, Trump's never going to leave. She believes it. The mentally ill single woman is the beating heart of the Democrat Party. Everyone listening or watching right now knows a woman in their life. Her eyes are half bugged out of her skull. She ruins Thanksgiving every time, bragging about her 15th abortion. Everyone knows a woman like this. I know you're laughing because I know you do, Megan. Everyone knows one. I can think of her right now. I can picture her in my mind. I wonder if she's seen that clip yet. Anyway, joining me now, Jennifer Gilardi, culture, health, and policy writer. And in fact, we had her on before, and we had her on to talk about the awesome piece that she wrote. We never even freaking got to it last time. She wrote a piece called Hell Hath No Fury Like a Single Liberal Woman. Such a great headline. Jennifer, what are you talking about in there?
I think they're very upset. They're very angry. And, you know, to be a little compassionate, why are they angry? Well, they've been kind of sold a bill of goods, I think, with the feminist movement. I know I was. It is a little bit of cultish. The tactics are like a cult, I think, on the progressive left. They kind of dismantle, we know that word, what did they call it with religion, where you have to like disassemble and question everything, which is good, but the rebuilding phase is not so great. So they kind of pull you away from family, they dig up trauma or any kind of your past that may disaffect you from your family, and then they instill these other values that I believe are anti-family, anti-Western, anti-Christian. And I see we're seeing that play out. I think what we're seeing on college campuses, we see many of these young students are women who have been brainwashed, and some of them don't even know what they're arguing for, right? We've seen that clip of the two girls going, do you actually know what this is about? And she's like, no, I don't. I think I need to do my research. You're like, yeah, you need to do your research. You need to know if you're going to be violent and angry, what you're violent and angry about. But I also think what I see in their like eyes and their soul, like somebody has ripped their soul out of their body is what it looks like to me. And I see that with a lot of these women, they're kind of, I don't know, they're lost and they're looking. And so they get trapped into this, they fall into this trap of the progressive kind of cult movement, and they get retrained to, I think, hate their bodies in a way, their own biology. The thing that makes them a woman, the beautiful thing that makes them a woman, whether they choose to go down that path or not, which is procreation. We see our own administration kind of vilifying that by saying, well, it doesn't really matter. We're going to allow men in your locker room. We don't care what you think.
Do you get the strain that they hate their country as well? Because obviously we know how it manifests. It manifests itself. They turn out to be loyal little street communists who go throw poop on people and do the things that Democrats want them to do. But is there an anti-America thing, or is it just anti-family, anti-men? What do they hate?
I think you can't separate those two. I think if you, okay, there's part of it is a self-hatred that gets projected out onto the world. And then they've been given someone to blame, which is typically white men, right? This is the reason for your problems. You're pushed down. You don't get an opportunity. The glass ceiling is real. And I mean, I get that conversation maybe 60 years ago, but women are in the workforce and they take prominent spots in medical schools. I don't see it as still a valid argument. And so now I find women just want something to whine about a lot of the times. And the left gives them a good excuse. Oh, it's the patriarchy. It is toxic masculinity. Look at all these examples of the Harvey Weinstein. Sure, of course, there's always going to be bad men. But as a whole, we are not a bad country. Men aren't terrible. Who's going to build the roads? You want to go do it? You want women? You want to go down in the streets and in the manholes and do all that kind of work? I mean, Camille Paglia is such a good, wonderful academic mind in this space who is pretty asexual. I think if she's not a lesbian, it has nothing to do with her sex. She just sees common sense and the writing on the wall. But again, the left they're angry about their own life, and then they've been given excuse to kind of project, and a lot of kind of venues and pathways to project that out into the world. And one of them is what we're seeing on college campuses, right? That's what's happening, I don't think, is so much even anti-Semitism. We just had a meeting about this here in DC. I'm on a task force. And it's not anti-Semitism, really. They don't even really, I think, know the history of the Middle East, a lot of them. It's anti-Western. It's anti-Christian. This is just the new BLM. And it happens to be a lot of women that are joining the movement. They've been, whether it's the woke mind virus, I think it's they don't like themselves as women.
I need to give everyone a little background. Jennifer used to be one, right? So she knows what she's talking about here. Now, this may or may not apply to you, but do you get the impression there was a parenting failure somewhere? I'm not saying they all had bad parents or something like that. Maybe they did all have bad parents, but did you get the impression that dad failed these ladies at some point, or mom failed these ladies, or it just is, you know, society is what it is. Young women are impressionable. You go off to college, you come back a nutball. Did you get the impression there's parenting failure here?
I do. And I think what my generation has done, I am Gen X, I think we've overcorrected for the distant parent, for the father that wasn't around, right? That whose job it was to just go to work and bring in money and support the family financially without maybe being there for the girls in the way little girls need, which is to be adored, to be loved, to be cherished. And if little girls don't have that growing up, if they don't feel their daddy loves them, right, and is there for them, I think they're going to go look for that out in the world. And that happened to be a little bit of my scenario. My dad was a great dad. He provided, he paid my way through undergraduate university. He just wasn't around a lot. And so I think the other thing I point to is like the nature of women, right? We tend to be more nurturing, compassionate. And I think the left takes advantage of that. And I was a very sensitive child and I felt people in pain. And I don't like to see people in pain. So the left does a good job on pulling those heartstrings, but I was also looking for like a daddy. I was looking for a father figure in my life. And I fell into kind of cultish sort of yoga groups and spirituality groups and all those things you hear about in like Los Angeles in the West, they're there. And I think whether it's conscious or unconsciously, they prey on women with insecurities who are just unsure of themselves. And I see this in, like I said, I wrote another piece about kind of the appearance of these college protesters and what they look like. They're not particularly attractive. They are wearing clothes that I've just, you know, it's like they have no concern for their appearance at all or their health.
I don't want to interrupt, but actually I wanted to ask you on that point, Jennifer, why are they, and I'm really not trying to be as insulting as I normally am. Why are so many of them fat and or ugly? Is it a chicken or the egg thing? Is this a young lady who maybe has felt the rejection of men, the rejection of society, and so she's found other women in that same place? Or is it so many years of bitterness? I mean, bitterness ages you worse than a carton a day of Marlboro Reds. What is it that does that? I'm really genuinely not trying to be mean, but you look at one of these feminist rallies, it's not exactly a bunch of women that look like you. It's just not.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. And I wrote about this in kind of, in that piece in The Federalist, the beginning of it was, you know, I'm not on the exactly the ugly side of the scale, but I did have a lot of insecurities about how I looked because I was in front of the camera. So I was always worried about how I looked and my appearance and not fitting into my business, which was in Hollywood, which was in the fitness business. So I always felt like I needed to be thinner and I needed to look a certain way according to society standards. I mean, I do think that that's there. So there's got to be a balance between putting beautiful women on the cover and that's okay because we appreciate beauty and we want to see those things, and then telling little girls that they all have to look like that, right? That this is taking care of yourself is a good, it is a virtue. We want to be healthy. We want to work with the gifts that God has given us and the body that God has given us. But we don't have to all look like supermodels. But when we don't look like supermodels, let's cultivate the other virtues in us, whether that's our intelligence, our artistic abilities, or our, you know, whatever it might be that make us powerful. And we're still women. We still have the biological tendencies of women to nurture and be compassionate. I think women play such a big role in this. And if we can find women that are truly empowered in their own biology and the power of being the life-giving sex, then we can, and not kind of project our any anger or any kind of frustration or disappointment we have from failed relationships, whatever they may be, onto the world, we really have a chance to change the society, change the culture. But I really think the left's done a great job at finding these women that are disillusioned, that don't like the way they look, that are insecure like I was, that that just don't have good role models, and they get sucked into this. And it makes them feel good because they found their tribe, right? Like that's a big kind of, that was a big tool in these spiritual communities I was in. It's like, we're your family now. We're your chosen family. And I was like, no, my family is my family. You're my friends. And I choose to hang around with you because I like you, but let's not get it twisted. My family is my family, you know? And so they kind of separate you from any historical background from any cultural lineage and from any patriotic pride in nation, right? Like, we are American. We should be proud. Sure, we have things to work on, but this is a great place to live. I've traveled all over the world. I'm always happy to come back here. And, you know, when you instill a hatred for kind of yourself, it's easy to hate other people and project on the world. That's what I see happening. I saw this video of, I don't know if you saw this, I'm sure you did, the baby that was pulled straight from its mother and put on the chest of a transgender man. I saw that last night and I have never been so enraged, upset, heartbroken. All of these emotions came flooding into me. And it was just like, what is going on? Because you felt that baby wanted it wanted its mother. It didn't. And I don't understand how anyone looks at that and says, that's okay. And the people that are looking at that and saying that's okay are mostly women. And it's not right. And I'm so angry.
I don't get it.
So
I don't get it. Jennifer, you are the best. We gotta go. That it's Dan, I'm telling you. It's a sick world out there. All right. We have Light in the Mood. Next.
I'm Maria Konnikova.
And I'm Nate Silver.
And our podcast, Risky Business, is a show about making better decisions. Both Nate and I are journalists who moonlight as poker players. We've both won, and I have to say lost, hundreds of thousands of dollars playing poker. And poker is a lens that we're going to use to approach this entire show, because poker isn't just about playing cards. It's actually about how to make good decisions. It's an entire framework for thinking about the world.
In addition to poker, we'll be talking about the wide world of gambling, so sports betting, for example, plus the news, politics, it is an election year, and personal decisions, too.
Like whether I should call a plumber or fix my shower myself.
Tune into Risky Business every Thursday.
Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
All right. It is time to lighten the mood. And look, how many times have we on this show talked about the importance of language? Language matters. We don't like to choose our words carefully. We just like to speak off the cuff, right? I like to, you like to. I don't have a teleprompter here, as you can probably tell. I just want to speak whatever is on my mind. But the communists, they choose their language carefully. Now, I'm not saying you should do that in all walks of life, but if you are in Home Depot, and let's say it was bratwurst night the night before, and troubles start coming, and bubbles start coming, you better be careful what language you use.
Some scary moments for customers at a Kansas Home Depot. Police responded to reports of a bomb threat at the store in Wichita. A customer alerted employees. A man inside the bathroom said there was a bomb in the building. Police were able to locate the man responsible for those comments, and that man told police he warned other guests to leave the restroom because he was, quote, fixing to blow it up, but had no intention of causing a panic. Man also told police others in the room laughed, understanding his joke, which I'm just now getting. Home Depot says they will not be pressing charges. But I can tell you right now, you asked the producer for me to read that, didn't you? To Ethan now, please.
No.
I'll see you tomorrow.
I'm Maria Konnikova.
And I'm Nate Silver.
And our new podcast, Risky Business, is a show about making better decisions. We're both journalists who moonlight as poker players, and that's the lens we're going to use to approach this entire show.
We're going to be discussing everything from high-stakes poker to personal questions.
Like whether I should call a plumber or fix my shower myself.
And of course, we'll be talking about the election, too.
Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.